Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Bush is asking Congress for more than $7 billion to deal with a possible flu pandemic. In a speech at the National Institutes of Health today, the president said the world needs to be prepared for the possibility that the current avian influenza virus could mutate and spread easily among humans.
If the virus were to develop the capacity for sustained human-to-human transmission, it could spread quickly across the globe. Our country has been given fair warning of this danger to our homeland and time to prepare.
The president's plan also involves spending $2.8 billion on vaccines to protect 20 million Americans against the current strain of bird flu, improving vaccine technology, and protecting vaccine manufacturers who are concerned about being sued.
Today, there is only one manufacturer in the United States that can produce influenza vaccine. That leaves our nation vulnerable in the event of a pandemic. We must increase the number of vaccine manufacturers in our country and improve our domestic production capacity, so Congress must pass liability protection for the makers of life-saving vaccines.
The president also wants close to $600 million to help state and local governments set up emergency plans and $1 billion to stockpile antiviral drugs. Well, joining us to talk about the president's plan is Dr. David Ozenoff, a professor of environmental health at Boston University's School of Public Health. Welcome.
Thank you.
Dr. Ozenoff, there's been a great deal of criticism about whether the government is prepared to deal with something like this. Are we at all sort of getting closer to being better prepared because of this plan outlined by the president today?
Well, at least we're talking about it, and we've recognized it at the highest levels of government, which is something that hasn't happened over the last couple of years. We're very late getting into this game, and probably what's being suggested is are necessary and minimal, but not anywhere near enough of what needs to be done. We're really presiding over a crumbling public health infrastructure. And without a public health infrastructure, it doesn't matter if you have a vaccine if you can't deliver the vaccine. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter if you have hospital beds if they're not staffed hospital beds. So we really have major problems that won't be solved by throwing money at a new technology for vaccines, a new technology that we've known about for years and we could have started 3, 4, 5 years ago.
Let's hear what the president had to say about that new vaccine technology today.
Right now, most vaccines are still produced with 1950s technology, using chicken eggs that are infected with the influenza virus and then used to develop and produce vaccines. In the event of a pandemic, this antiquated process would take many, many months to produce a vaccine, and it would not allow us to produce enough vaccine for every American in time.
So the president is saying that this new technology could produce enough vaccines for every American within 6 months. Is that realistic?
No, it's not true that it could produce vaccines for every American within 6 months. It's not true that it'll be ready in 6 months. It's probably not true that it'll be ready in 3 years. But this is a technology that's not new technology. It's been around for several years, and there wasn't any effort put into developing this technology because the federal government has relied entirely on the private sector, and the private sector hasn't wanted to make it because they can make a lot more money making impotence drugs.
What about the plan to stockpile antivirals like Tamiflu? Will that help, do you think?
Well, right now, Tamiflu and a similar drug called Relenza are the only drugs that really are active against influenza A of this type that we know about. And they do work, but they work only on the margin. For example, if you take Tamiflu very soon after you start developing symptoms, you will lessen the duration of your illness by about a day, and you will lessen the duration of your fever by about 26 hours. That's something, that's a good thing, but it certainly is not a magic bullet that's going to cure this disease. It's not a cure, it just alleviates the symptoms in some people to some extent. It can also be used prophylactically if you've been exposed, but it's not realistic to think, even if we had enough of this drug, which we don't, that you're going to take this drug every day during a typical pandemic wave, which may go 6 weeks or 7 weeks, that 200 or 300 million people are going to take this drug every single day. Well, we're talking about a billion capsules, and right now there's only about 2 or 3 million in the stockpile.
Mm-hmm. And the manufacturer of Tamiflu, Roche, has said that it's going to limit supplies to some countries. Why can't another company just start making Tamiflu or a version of it?
Well, right now the patent for this drug is held by Gilead Sciences, which has licensed it to Roche. Roche didn't discover this drug. They bought the license. So violating their patent wouldn't have any effect on innovation and research because it didn't have any effect in the first place. In fact, most of the research for this was done originally by taxpayer money through NIH. They do have a monopoly on it, a legal monopoly that's been granted by our intellectual property rights. But it doesn't work very well for life-saving drugs like this. And right now they're being forced to sublicense to various generic manufacturers because the pressure on them is so great.
And so those are the reports that we're hearing that India and Vietnam will start producing versions of this.
Well, no. India and Vietnam have said they're going to do it without sublicenses. They're just going to go ahead and break the patent. In the face of that, Roche has decided that they're going to actually legally sublicense it to some generic makers, although they'll still have control over it.
Mm-hmm. And in order to do that, is there a citation of a public health crisis that they would have to say that this is happening in order for this sublicense to be awarded?
No, they're free to issue sublicenses as they wish, as a normal business practice. On the other hand, Vietnam and India, if they want to break the patent, there is a provision in the World Trade Organization that allows them to do that in the case of a national emergency. The United States almost invoked that clause itself during the anthrax attacks when there wasn't enough Cipro antibiotic and Bayer was not selling it to others.
Right. So if the president's plan is maybe sort of a step in one direction, but parts of it are not very realistic, what would you say that the country should focus on right now to be better prepared for something like this?
Well, what it really needs to do is beef up its public health infrastructure. You can't beef up hospitals and say that there's going to be greater hospital capacity. Right now, everybody in a hospital bed is sick. You can't kick them out of a hospital bed right now. But we need not only more hospital beds, we need more staffed hospital beds. You can't do that if you're going to cut Medicaid and Medicare, which is what Congress, the Republican Congress, is proposing to do. And beyond that, there are so many aspects of our infrastructure that would be affected. Food delivery, drug delivery to pharmacies, water and power if there were a pandemic that caused 30% to 40% absenteeism in our workforce. There's a great deal of work that needs to be done at the local level.
All right. Well, thanks very much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
Dr. David Ozenoff teaches environmental health at the Boston University School of Public Health. And while President Bush asks Congress for more money to stockpile antiviral drugs like Tamiflu, prescriptions for the drug are skyrocketing. They're about 10 times above what they were at this time last year, so supplies are running low. Further exacerbating this is that some patients and doctors are hoarding the drug. Joining us to talk about this is Dr. Tom Lee. He's network president of Partners Healthcare in Boston. Dr. Lee, you oversee more than 3,500 doctors in New England. Are many of them stockpiling Tamiflu?
Not very many of them are, but some of them are. And it doesn't take very many to make a difference because there's only enough Tamiflu for about 2% of the population. The drug hardly has been used in the past. So even a few people hoarding Tamiflu makes a big difference, and the fact is we're all almost out of Tamiflu, healthcare providers and non-healthcare providers.
And so when you say a few, what are we talking about percentage-wise, and what are they doing when they're hoarding the Tamiflu?
Lots of people, patients, doctors, nurses, are reading the newspapers, and they're getting scared. And they're getting prescriptions for Tamiflu, some for 10-day supplies, some for 100-day supplies. They're running around finding a pharmacy that will fill them, and they're taking them home and putting it in their medicine cabinets next to their 2-year-old supplies of ciprofloxacin, which they bought for anthrax.
And so how would you describe the supply right now, at least for your particular organization?
Well, I think the supply for the whole region and for the whole country is vanishing. I think that there's I think people are having a great deal of difficulty finding stores that supply it, And I don't think that that's a bad thing, really, in that, Roche, the manufacturer, has cut off distribution so that supplies can be stockpiled in case there is a pandemic. So the hoarding practice by both patients and healthcare workers is about to run its course because there just won't be any other Tamiflu available.
Should we be worried about a pandemic?
Well, we should be worried about a pandemic. We should be real worried about a pandemic. I don't think that hoarding of Tamiflu, though, is a very bright way for us to try to prepare for it.
What are you most concerned about in terms of people hoarding this?
There are three or four things that are wrongheaded about the hoarding. One is that if there is a pandemic, what we need to be able to do is to tap into a supply of this drug to try to give it to people who are sick and to also give it to the healthcare workers who are taking care of those patients. If there were a pandemic, the advice would be for everyone who can to stay home and to avoid spreading this disease to other people, and for healthcare workers to take care of the people who are sick, to try to get them through this. You need those healthcare workers to actually be protected to get them to show up for work. So we need an adequate supply to do that. If the supply were to be exhausted, we, of course, won't be able to take care of the patients or the doctors and nurses. The other problem, of course, is that people will start using it incorrectly and they'll cultivate resistance so that the influenza that does spread around, both avian and non-avian, we won't be able to stop it at all with this tool. There already is evidence of Tamiflu-resistant avian influenza out there.
You're a healthcare worker. Your wife is a doctor. Do you have Tamiflu or do you want to have it for yourselves and your family? And you could say that you need it as the first line of defense against this.
Well, I'd be lying if I said it didn't run through my mind to get a prescription for, to keep around for my family. But there are several reasons why I didn't, besides the fact that it would be, somewhat sociopathic and a bit embarrassing if anyone found out that I'd done this. One is that it's the chances that it will be helpful are really, really low. This is on the order of garlic cloves to fend off vampires in terms of its chances of really protecting you. In that, suppose there is a pandemic. The pandemic will go on months, maybe years. Is a 10-day supply of Tamiflu really going to, make a difference for even the individual who got that prescription? I don't think so. The second reason is that, the chances that it will be needed and used this year, 2005, 2006, I think are pretty low. And they're frankly a lot better things that one can do with $100 to try to improve your chances of living a long and full life than spend it on Tamiflu this year. Join a health club, for example.
Dr. Tom Lee is Network President of Partners Healthcare in Boston. And coming up later this week, a look at the deadliest flu pandemic in the last century, the Spanish flu of 1918. We'll talk with author Myla Goldberg, who poignantly captured that tragedy in her new book, Wicket's Remedy. And just ahead, the increasing pressure on Syria to cooperate with United Nations investigators looking into the assassination of Lebanon's former prime minister. Stay with us. That's coming up here and now. I'm Deborah Becker. It's Here and Now. Syria is now under increased pressure to cooperate with the United Nations investigator who's looking into the assassination of former Lebanese Prime Minister Rafik Hariri. The UN Security Council has unanimously voted to demand that Syria expand its cooperation or face unspecified further action. The Council's resolution follows a UN report that identified high-ranking Syrian officials as having been complicit in the February 14th bombing in Beirut that killed Hariri and 22 others. Joining us on the line from New York is Rami Khoury. He's editor of Lebanon's Daily Star newspaper. Rami, what does this resolution mean for the Syrian government?
The Syrians are really in a corner now. This is a very explicit resolution. It's passed unanimously. It's done under Chapter 7. It was done by the foreign ministers. I mean, there's about four or five levels of intensity here and clarity that the Syrians really need to come to grips with much more seriously than they have to date, that they must give the UN what it wants or they're in deep trouble.
And specifically, it outlines that there will be new powers given to the UN investigator.
Right, and they've set up a commission or a committee, which is actually, I mean, it's a really almost an unprecedented, I think it is unprecedented in UN history, to set up an investigating committee to look into a crime, a murder crime, committed in a country, in Lebanon, and they are saying that they are suspicious of officials and organizations in another country, which is Syria, and that this resolution now demands from the Syrians full compliance in carrying out this investigation. So it's quite a serious precedent, and the Syrians really have run out of options. They must comply, and if they don't comply, they're going to be under much, much greater pressure. If they are complicit in this, they're in trouble. If they're not complicit in this, they will probably be able to find a way out for the regime to continue to rule in Syria, but they're going to probably have to sacrifice some of the individuals if some individuals are actually found to be guilty.
Mm-hmm. Such as the Syrian president's brother and brother-in-law, yes?
That's right, and among other people. So, and this gets to the heart of the regime. I mean, these regimes are really family-run affairs in many Middle Eastern countries. There's a small circle of a couple of dozen people at most who are the real powers, and once you start encroaching on that circle, you really start to shake the foundations of the regime. So it's still not clear who is guilty or not. I mean, to be fair to them, they're innocent until proven guilty, and the council has made that very clear. But the council is also, the report that was submitted to the Security Council also clearly points fingers in the direction of Syrian security organizations. So they really are in a corner now, and they have to get out of it only by complying. They cannot use the traditional tactics of delaying or making accusations or saying they're cooperating but not really cooperating or playing for time or trying to play people off against each other. The fact that you got 15 members of the council voting for this is very significant.
What about President Assad? A lot of folks have described this as a moment of truth for his regime. Do you see it that way?
Oh, absolutely. This is really a moment of reckoning for him as an individual, as a leader, and for the regime. But also, I would even go one step further. This is the first instance we have of an international legitimate diplomatic attempt, and I stress legitimate, unlike what the U.S. did in Iraq. This is a legitimate international attempt to intervene in the affairs of a sovereign Arab country, and it's really the first example of using the rule of law to check the security institutions that rule most of the Arab countries. So this is very significant.
There are reports of pro-government demonstrations in Damascus. People are angry about this resolution and say that the initial U.N. report on Rafi Hariri's assassination was already biased against Syria, and it's not fair. How do you think most Syrians view this whole effort to get to the bottom of this?
I think Syrians are confused a little bit because instinctively they would like to protect their country's national dignity and sovereignty. They don't like people prying into its affairs. At the same time, I think they would go along with the evidence. If the evidence is clear and does not seem to be political but is factual, then I think Syrians would have no option but to go along with this. And you have to be careful about public demonstrations in Syria and Libya and Tunisia and Egypt and places like that. A lot of these are orchestrated by the government and the security services, so they may or may not reflect the real sentiments of the people. But certainly there is a rallying around the president in Syria. There is a sense that let the burden of proof be clear and let the quality of the evidence be very clear. If the evidence is clear, then I think people will go along with it. But there is a fear that this is still politically motivated, and all they really want to do is change the regime in Syria or change its behavior to suit American goals in Iraq and Israeli interests and things of that nature.
Mm-hmm. When you mentioned Libya, I heard that some folks have questioned whether President Assad will have a, quote, Gaddafi moment, referring to the Libyan president's decision to stop its development of nuclear weapons in exchange for international acceptance. Do you think that Assad has the necessary domestic support to make that kind of decision?
The only option he has now is to do a combination of a Gorbachev and a Gaddafi. He must do a Gorbachev in terms of a significant internal restructuring and liberalization, economic and political, to give people what they want and to improve their living standards and to improve their the dignity of their political life and participation. At the same time, he must do a Gaddafi to give the Western world and the UN what it legitimately requires in terms of the regime's regional behavior, to be in compliance with the law. If he does both of those things, I think he might be able to remain in power, but it would be a very different kind of regime. The interesting thing is that the government in Syria now is not under significant pressure to change its internal governing system, and the same as Gaddafi. The West doesn't care if he runs a police state and has massive human rights denials and corruption. The West doesn't really care about any of those things. All it wants to do is prevent the spread of weapons of mass destruction. And the same with Syria. They really care about its regional behavior in Iraq and in Israel and Palestine, Iran, Hezbollah. They don't particularly care if the Syrians live in a free society or a dictatorship or somewhere in between.
Rami, thanks very much for speaking with us.
All right. Thanks. Take care.
Rami Khoury is the editor of Lebanon's Daily Star newspaper. He spoke to us from New York City. Tomorrow on Here and Now, we hear from some workers who thought they were headed for the easy life when they retired. Instead, they found out their benefits had been cut. And Rod Stewart, who hasn't retired, gives another spin to some standards. Stay with us. There is more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Deborah Becker. It's Here and Now. China's controversial one-child policy is under revision, with cash rewards now being offered to rural couples with only one child or two daughters. Family planning officials hope these rewards will help farmers change their age-old preference for boys and maintain a low birth rate. At the same time, China is acknowledging problems in its countryside that include a brutal campaign of forced abortions and sterilizations conducted by local officials in the Linyi region of China's eastern province of Shandong. The government is not discussing numbers, but Time magazine reported that at least 7,000 people were forced to undergo abortions or sterilizations in just one county of Linyi during a five-month period this year. Here and Now's Robin Young recently spoke with Time's Shanghai bureau chief, Hannah Beach.
I've done a lot of reporting on terrible incidents in China's countryside, but I think this is one of the most brutal and shocking things I've ever seen in my 5 years here. The anecdote that I actually led the story with is about a woman who was forced to abort her baby 2 days before the due date, and she was 9 months pregnant with her second child and had tried to evade the local family planning officials for weeks, but her father-in-law was detained and beaten up, and she was forced to go into the local clinic basically to have him released from jail.
And they pinned her down?
They pinned her down. They inserted a needle filled with poison into the fetus's head and killed the baby. And 10 hours later, she delivered the child, and you know, needless to say, it was dead.
Well, we said this is tough stuff, and it is. Even after she delivered the child, the officials, to make sure the child was dead, did what?
They actually dunked the baby in a bucket of water for a couple minutes right by her bedside.
Yeah.
It's the kind of thing that's very difficult to interview somebody about. Yeah.
This is horrific. And you say that maybe 7,000 people in one county alone may have been forced to either abort or sterilize. First of all, do you think those numbers are accurate?
The 7,000 number was given to several Chinese lawyers who spoke to local family planning officials in this county called Yinan. And I think at the time, the local family planning guys were quite proud of the number. They said, hey, we've done at least 7,000. Isn't that great? We're doing our jobs well. But, you know, we don't have hard numbers of what's happening in other counties. I think anecdotally, it appears that what happened in this one county, Yinan, is no different than what's happened in any other county in Linyi. So if you extrapolate the Yinan number and apply it to other counties, you might be talking about something like 120,000 women.
Remind us, why is this happening? We know that this one-child policy went into effect 25 years ago. It was China's attempt to limit their, you know, exploding population. And it had some variations to it, correct? I mean, if you have a girl, you are allowed to have another child to try to get a boy.
Right. And the funny Chinese formulation is if your first child is physically handicapped or mentally handicapped or a girl, you are allowed to have a second child. But the one-child policy was never really a one-child policy in the countryside. In the countryside, often you were allowed to have two kids. It just sort of depended on who happened to be in charge in your local province. But the funny thing is that in 2002, the one-child policy was actually loosened. And instead of outlawing extra children outright, Beijing basically said, okay, we strongly encourage you not to have extra kids, but if you're willing to pay a big fine, then you can have extra children. The problem is that the promotion of local party officials in the local regions is still dependent on keeping the number of extra children low. So, you know, if a local official has tamed corruption and increased incomes and provided, you know, clean drinking water but hasn't slowed down the rate of extra birth, they're not going to get promoted. And that's exactly what seems to have happened in Linyi. Last year at a provincial-level meeting, Linyi was singled out for having the highest number of extra births in the entire province of Shandong. And I don't think it's a coincidence that soon after this, the brutal sterilization and abortion campaign started.
And by the way, we just want to add that, you know, even though the state said that people could pay a fee to waive the policy, they can't afford that fee.
True enough. But at least it does introduce a modicum of choice.
So it seems as if there's been a shift on the part of the state that somehow didn't filter down to local officials, or as you say, local officials felt the pressure to still, you know, crack down. But how is the state responding to your revelations?
Well, there's good news and bad news. The good news is soon after our story appeared, the State Family Planning Commission, which is in Beijing, it's a central government body that came out and said, look, we messed up. And some of these Linyi officials messed up, and some of them have either been fired or arrested. And that's, you know, that's a big change from before, where I think Beijing adopted a sort of hear no evil, see no evil.
Well, I was going to say, the fact that they even acknowledged your report in the state papers, which we're reading, is amazing. But then you're also saying they made a mistake.
Right. And that's the good news. The bad news is that there appears to be a disconnect between what the central government says it's doing and what's actually being done. You know, yes, it does appear that several lower-level family planning officials have been arrested, but no one higher up has been arrested. And, in fact, the lawyer whom we contacted who's tried to publicize what's been happening in Linyi is still under house arrest. He was arrested in Beijing a couple hours after we met with him, and that was in early September, and he's been detained since then. And, in fact, he was beaten up by local thugs when he tried to leave his house to meet with a couple of lawyers who were visiting from Beijing. Two of the six people that we interviewed in early September were also arrested and kept in jail for several days.
Hannah, this policy was instituted to try to somehow slow down this huge population explosion in China. Isn't there another way to do it, and is the state considering other ways?
Well, I think the one-child policy started, you know, partly to decrease the population, but it was also seen as a shortcut to economic success. You know, the idea was you reduce the population, there are fewer mouths to feed, and you've got more money to go around. If you talk to the average Chinese, they think it's a good thing. It's making their country modern, and by which they mean a country that has a smaller population. I think that the fact that the policy was changed in 2002, as I mentioned before, from outlawing extra children outright to discouraging people from having more kids through big fines, is a signal that the government realizes that policies like this are not the smartest idea, and there have been, you know, incredibly serious repercussions from this policy.
Hannah Beach is Time Magazine's Shanghai Bureau Chief. She spoke with Here and Now's Robin Young. As always, we welcome your thoughts about our program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@HERE-NOW.ORG. Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please tell us how to pronounce your name and tell us the town you're from. Still to come, a new field guide to a pretty fantastic world. You're listening to Here and Now. Boston is abuzz with news of the departure of Theo Epstein, the 31-year-old local guy who became the general manager of the Boston Red Sox and helped lead the team to a World Series championship last year. Epstein took the job in 2002. At the time, he was the youngest GM in Major League Baseball, and just 1 year after the 2004 spectacular season, he's gone. Here to talk about Epstein's departure is Only a Game's Bill Littlefield. Hello, Bill. What happened?
Well, it depends on how much time you have. The long explanation will be hashed out in the Globe and the Herald, probably until spring training begins at least, or at least perhaps until they name a new general manager. The short answer is the Red Sox had the opportunity to begin talking to Theo Epstein last spring when he mentioned that he only had less than a year remaining on his contract to them, reminded them of that, and they chose not to do it. They chose to treat him like a player, which is, we'll wait until the season's over and talk to you then. And then when they did start talking to him, they offered him much less money than his market value. And I think that got everything off on the wrong foot, and there have been all sorts of complications since then, including the always intriguing philosophical differences, which means perhaps that Epstein likes Schopenhauer and Mr. Lucchino doesn't. I don't know what that means.
As we said, Boston is abuzz about this, but does anybody outside of Red Sox Nation care?
Well, somebody should, because he may end up being the general manager somewhere else, and he has a track record to be envied. He's three years as a general manager, and he's taken a team to the playoffs all 3 years and won a world championship. So, you know, somebody will get him somewhere down the line. There ought to be some excitement, perhaps in Philadelphia or Washington, D.C. or somewhere.
Right. How critical do you think the GM is to a team's success?
It's a really interesting question. You look at pitching. That's the most important component of any baseball team. But if the general manager is the guy who's responsible for acquiring the key pitcher, Mr. Epstein went and had Thanksgiving dinner with Curt Schilling and convinced him that he should leave the Arizona Diamondbacks and become a member of the Boston Red Sox, then all of a sudden you say, gee, the general manager is pretty important if he's willing to get up out of his office, get on a plane, and go have dinner with Curt Schilling. It's an interesting question, but I think in this particular case, Epstein was very important to the Red Sox winning a world championship. He brought some fresh air into an organization that definitely needed it. Young, confident fellow with all kinds of good ideas, and the good ideas turned out to be sufficiently good so they won a world championship for the first time in 86 years last year.
Larry Lucchino, one of the Red Sox owners, was a mentor, really, to Epstein. Is this a case at all of a student saying, well, I've outgrown my
mentor? Yeah, I'm a little uncomfortable laying a Freudian explanation on a baseball matter. I always try to steer away from that sort of thing. But it is true. Lucchino and Epstein had worked together in Baltimore. They worked together in San Diego. Then they worked together in Boston. The way baseball works, who knows? They may work together somewhere else, somewhere down the line. Stranger things have happened. Certainly there was a kind of a master-mentor or mentor-pupil relationship going on there, but the extent to which that's responsible, I have really no idea.
And what about the Red Sox are partially owned by the parent company of the Boston Globe newspaper, and the Globe printed a number of stories on the negotiations that were going on between the team and Epstein, including a recent article that said that an agreement had been reached and he was staying. Now, mm-hmm. how does this relationship between the newspaper and the team affect negotiations?
Well, given the number of extremely important stories that the New York Times and the Boston Globe regularly cover, it's a little hard for me to believe that the relationship in the newspaper company company to the baseball team has huge significance. But again, who knows? There have been charges that some of the stuff in Dan Shaughnessy's piece over the weekend convinced Epstein that Lucchino was kind of spinning stories to make him look bad, and that was what kind of convinced him he couldn't possibly work with Lucchino. Shaughnessy has pointed out, I think, logically, that Epstein is probably not dumb enough to take his cue from a column in the Globe. But, you know, who knows? Again, anybody's guess.
How about you, Bill? Are you applying for the gig?
Well, I didn't get the Supreme Court gig, so yeah, sure. my phone number's listed.
Bill Littlefield of NPR is Only a Game. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
There is more ahead. Stay with us, Here and Now. I'm Deborah Becker. It's Here and Now. What do Madonna, Paul McCartney, and Salman Rushdie have in common? They're all artists who are writing children's books. And after the cultural phenomenon of Harry Potter, series books are so popular that the New York Times bestseller list now includes children's series in a separate category. On that list is the series The Spiderwick Chronicles, which tells the story of the three Grace children who discover an old field book describing a hidden magical world around the gloomy new house they move to after their parents' divorce. The latest in the series is a reproduction of that old field book titled Arthur Spiderwick's Field Guide to the Fantastical World Around You. Its creators, Tony Dieterlese and Holly Black, are joining us on the line from the University of Massachusetts Amherst campus. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
There are now, Tony, 3 million copies of your books in about 30 languages, and this comes after Harry Potter and The Lord of the Rings and The Chronicles of Narnia. Is this just a particularly good time to write about fantasy?
Holy cow. Are you serious? 3 million? I didn't actually know that. We knew that it was popular in other parts of the world, but it has been pretty unbelievable.
Many things are sort of popular in cycles, and I think that, you know, for me as a fantasy lover and also, you know, working on fantasy books, it's a really great time because right now fantasy is sort of mainstream popular. It has mainstream popularity. I mean, a few years ago we had comics that were very popular.
Mm-hmm.
I remember in the 80s there were a lot of fantasy movies coming out then.
Right, definitely. And it's, I think you and I have talked about that before. Mm-hmm. I mean, Jim Henson was making movies like The Dark Crystal and Labyrinth. That was actually the first time I read Lord of the Rings, was actually, because I was like in like middle school, going into high school,
right.
And that's that time where you really kind of discover all that really good, delicious fantasy.
And so what age group, Tony, would you say that the Spiderwick Chronicles is sort of geared toward?
When Holly and I sat down and we kind of knew what the story was going to be, we figured, you know, Holly said, well, it's going to take me about 500 or 600 pages to probably tell this story. And that was with the illustrations that I wanted to add. And we thought, man, there's a lot of other books out already that are aimed at a certain age group that are about that long. And we were sitting in Simon & Schuster with our editor, Kevin, and he said, you know, what if you just broke the books up a little smaller and we made them for younger audiences? We don't dumb them down or simplify them at all. We simply just make them a little more bite-sized. And so that said, I would say probably around 7, 8 years old is probably into like 9 and 10 seems to be like the prime age range. Mm-hmm. For these books.
Okay. Yeah, it's been really interesting how much kids can read more sophisticated language than I had, you know, originally thought they would mm-hmm. let us get away with. And they seem to kids seem to have no problem with it because of, you know, they're fast paced. They're pretty short.
What about some of the concepts in the books? The books talk about divorce, death, then there are anger issues in the main character in the book, Jared. Is this subject matter maybe a little bit too complex, or are kids sophisticated enough to handle that, do you think?
I think kids are sophisticated enough to handle it. I think that when you're working on a kid's book, you have to really think about what it's like to be that age, kind of think back to what it was like for, I try and think back to what it was like for me to be that age and the issues that were important to me. And I think at that age, it's all about the family.
Yeah.
The family is so much more a part of your life than it is later when your friends become, you know, the sort of center of your life. And I really wanted Jared to be a little bit different. Now, I mean, I was a geeky kid growing up, and there are a lot of books about sort of the geeky kid who, you know, makes good.
Saves the world, yeah.
And, right. You know, I love those books. but I was excited to try and think about a kid who had anger issues, who really wasn't that kid, who was kind of more the
misunderstood.
Yeah, like crazy kid in class.
And I think the other thing, too, that I know we both are pretty proud of is the Grace kids, the heroes, they're just ordinary kids in really extraordinary circumstances. And I think some of the other more popular books tend to be extraordinary kids in extraordinary circumstances. And I think it just went back. Holly and I really sat and talked about a lot of the books that we cherished when we were around this age and the books that we liked. And a lot of them were just, it was like a kid, like someone you knew, or maybe it was you. So it was easy to project into one of the characters and kind of go along the journey as you read the books.
Mm-hmm. You introduced the field guide, Tony, with the question, what is real? Why mm-hmm. do you think that's an important concept for kids?
I think it really goes, the little bit of backstory that we put in about Arthur Spiderwick, who's the fellow who actually made the field guide and claims he saw all this stuff, the point he had was, no one else can see what I can see, but I can see it, and therefore, to me, it's real. And I think that asks a really, really big question. Just because you can't see something, does that make it not real? Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of people believe in God. They can't see him. You know, I mean, I'm not saying that's where we were necessarily going with it, but it's a quick, easy answer to this concept of belief and how strong are your beliefs about what it is you witness.
Mm-hmm. In June, the two of you published a notebook, yes, for children to write their observations. Holly, have you had kids send you their work as they respond to the Spiderwick Chronicles?
Yeah, absolutely. We've had, even earlier, before the notebook came out, when we went on tour, we brought this red book where kids could write their own fair experiences. And it was amazing how often kids would either raise their hand when we were talking and, you know, asking for questions and tell us, you know, here's this weird thing that happened to me. There were lights outside my window. I saw a little man running, you know, running by out of the corner of my eye. I knew it couldn't be the cat because the cat was on my bed. You know, really fascinating little stories. I know when I was a kid, my mom once arranged the scavenger hunt, which was, you know, supposedly the, you know, by the fairies. And when I went kind of through the yard looking for this, I remember finding all these weird nooks and crannies and stuff that she didn't plan that seemed to me clearly, you know, this is evidence that there are fairies out there. This is clearly, you know, where they must live. This is, you know, clearly what they must eat. And so I think that with the notebook, I think if any kid goes out into any yard, they're going to find stuff to put in that book.
Mm. When you go and do a book signing, a lot of times you do meet a young reader who's like, I like to write stories, or I like to do drawings, and mm-hmm. I come up with characters on my own. And somehow that seems encouraged up to a certain age. And then you're the weird kid who likes to come up with stories and likes to do drawings of little creatures. And so I think it was kind of our statement on saying, hey, you know, if you really like doing this sort of thing, you never know what could happen.
Mm-hmm. What about in the Chronicles themselves? There's a lot of discussion about the field guide and the danger that having the field guide brings. And now you're publishing the field guide, the much coveted field guide. is it going to be scary for kids to have it?
We're in danger.
Well, I mean, opening your eyes to the magical, fantastical world of fairy means, you know, opening your eyes to sort of dangerous things, goblins and trolls, not nice creatures. I mean, the thing about the field guide is hopefully forewarned is forearmed.
Right.
And at least knowing what's out there and being able to know how to see it, you know, you can protect yourself.
Well, now that it's out, any more stories involving the Grace children?
I think the Grace Children's have had quite enough. That's been one heck of an adventure that they've been on.
They need a rest.
They need a break. But I got to tell you, Holly and I had such a great time working together. We've been friends for many years prior to working on the Spiderwick books together. And we both have a love for stories and telling a yarn or two. And I think it probably won't be the last that you hear from the team of Dieter Leese and Black.
Well, thanks very much to both of you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Tony Dieter Leese and Holly Black are the creators of Arthur Spiderwick's Field Guide to the Fantastical World Around You, which is now in bookstores. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Robin Young will be back tomorrow. Join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.